Welcome to 2500 Del Monte Street, the oral history of Tower Records. Today's guest, Matt Lavelle. Welcome back. I'm your host, Bob Zimmerman. Matt Lavelle is on the show today. When Stan Gohman thinks of great jazz buyers, he thought of Artie Moorhead. When I think of great jazz buyers, my go-to is Matt Lavelle. We worked together a couple of years at Tower Lincoln Center, and Matt was both the jazz buyer and the floor manager. I think he took to buying quicker than managing, but with some work, he did great in both capacities. Before hitting the jazz floor, Matt worked as a receiving guru in a store that never saw a slowdown in product. Today, Matt and I talk about his evolution as a jazz fan and ultimately a very well-respected performer, the characters who made up the jazz, vocals, oldies, world, Broadway, soundtracks room in Store 866, Matt's weekly live jazz series he sponsored in the Lincoln Center store, working in the store and in the receiving department on 9/11, and the time he spent with Robin Williams finding just the right CD for Robin's son. Enjoy my conversation with Matt Lavelle. Matt Lavelle, welcome to 2500 Del Monte Street.
Hey, Bob, how you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
It's been a minute.
Yeah. 2006.
Yeah.
To be exact.
Yeah.
Well, good. I'm so glad you're willing to do this. I like to cover a lot of different facets of what went down at Tower, and you are one of the people I think of when I think of jazz at Tower. The time we worked together in Lincoln Center, I thought you did a killer job. As the jazz buyer and the jazz floor manager, and the fact that you're still an active jazz musician, just all that stuff plays into it, and you've got a lot of depth in terms of, you know, you did a lot of other stuff at Tower, so I'm looking forward to this.
Well, you know, in thinking back about three different stints at Tower. I think it's over 10 years total, but to get to the jazz buyer spot took me a long time. And going back to the very beginning of the whole thing, when I first in the early 90s I was doing a night shift at a supermarket. And things were getting really out of control at that job. That's like a whole other crazy story. But I was like, why don't I just go work at a record store?
Yeah.
And I was in my early 20s, maybe even younger than that. I don't know, maybe like 20 or 21 or something like that. And Tower Records, I always known about Tower. I was like, and I always loved Tower as a jazz musician. Tower was legendary, man.
Yeah.
The jazz section at Tower was always a real big deal. And the times when I would go into the city in the early 90s, it was the main objective before I worked at Tower was to go to the Village Tower jazz department, which was just the most amazing place in the world to a jazz musician. This was this is when all the CDs were in those crazy plastic.
The long boxes.
The long boxes.
Yes.
They were all in the long boxes. And I had so many of my friends were working in that Village Tower. Uh-huh. But it was such a thing, though, to be in the city, and I used to plan specific amount of, you know, time to go there. And when I got there, I had a whole thing about starting at A and literally flipping
Cannonball Adderley.
Yep. And going step by step all the way to the end. And it was always, you know, I mean, I don't even recall being able to go online or anything like that.
No, yeah.
At that time. Yeah. So the Tower Records jazz section was the ultimate source of everything in jazz. It's like, what's going on? The past, the present. I mean,
what's being reissued? What's coming out? Absolutely. Well, let's do this. Before we get into too much Tower stuff, let's talk about your formative years. Now, where did you grow up? Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Paterson, New Jersey. But I didn't live there. Uh-huh. As a kid, I was in upstate New York in Monroe. And I eventually, in high school, I was in Nyack, New York. And
Nyack, is that like Long Island? I'm not good with...
Oh, yeah. It's like, Nyack was adjacent to Nanuet, which is just above the city. Like,
okay.
So Nyack's like a half hour above Manhattan.
Okay.
Maybe 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And Nanuet was right there. And that's how I ended up.
I got you.
At the Nanuet Tower.
I got you. So tell me about the role music played in your life starting as just a young kid. Did you come from a musical family?
My grandfather was a great artist, and he used to sit me down when I was little to listen to symphonies.
So when you say he was a visual artist?
Yeah, he was a great painter.
Yeah, and, but he would sit you down and play music for you.
Yeah, and
how old were you when you're hearing symphonies?
You know, this was like 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
And we just sit there and listen to like Beethoven, and he wouldn't say nothing. We would sit down, he'd put it on, and we would just listen. And I didn't know anything about jazz. I didn't even know jazz existed at that age.
Right, right.
But I did.
Like when the record was over, did he talk to you about it?
He didn't even say that much, but I would watch him listening, and I could see that he was being moved by the music. Like
he was taking it in,
feeling the scene. He was taking it in.
Yeah.
And I think that was the lesson, really. You know, that music was something important that you could feel.
Right. Right.
You know, on a human level. At least that's what I took from it.
And, so at what age were you starting to feel? And again, it was probably pop music, you know, as for a lot of people, that's where they start. But when did you start either listening to the radio or watching MTV or listening to things at friends' houses? What was the early stuff you were listening to?
I mean, that's pretty funny, actually, because I listened to everything, you know, like the stuff that was on the radio. And uh-huh. I remember songs from back then. They still creep. They still come into my head, and and I still remember a lot of music from the TV shows back then. But I started playing trumpet in elementary school. So this is always kind of funny and a little interesting too. Is that my father used to try to get me music or get me records that were trumpet related. So, which was actually kind of cool, but he didn't know anything about jazz. Uh-huh. So what happened was he got me Herb Alpert's Rise and Chuck Mangione, Feel So Good.
Uh-huh.
And these are classics. These are classics, man. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the hardcore jazz guys, like I am now myself, like
right.
Hardcore, be like, oh no, you know, it's all about, you know, it's all about Miles and the most extreme levels.
Yeah,
but in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, that was really my introduction to any kind of instrumental stuff that wasn't classical. And Chuck Mangione, plays great on Feels So Good. You know, he's become kind of like a pop, kind of like a cult pop figure,
right,
kind of,
right,
kind of guy. And Herb Albert was like this major producer. I mean, he wasn't the greatest player, but Rise is a pretty smooth album. I mean, and I think Rise has been sampled probably a whole bunch of times.
Oh, okay.
By you know, by the hip hop community.
Yeah.
Hey, at least a few times I know I've heard Rise, you know, brought in or adapted or used or anything. You know, but my father also got me a Village People LP, and the LP came with posters of the guys you could put on your wall.
No, I don't remember a lot of trumpet on those records.
No. So that was just pure
pop, just whatever was happening at the time.
Being a kid, yeah.
And
Village People
movie. You know what's funny is just speaking of the Village People, I remember going to visit my grandmother in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and my cousins who lived in northern New Jersey and listened to New York radio stations. I remember they came up to my grandmother, and again, I don't, what's that, 78, 76, 77, I don't know. So I'm 13 or 14, and I don't remember Macho Man and that stuff getting played on the radio in D.C., and they put it on. And everyone just, that was like what was being played at the time. You know what I mean? That was just plain old pop music. You know, you didn't get the subtext of what was being sung about and stuff, you know? So
yeah,
it's kind of funny. That was just absolutely the norm, you know?
I mean, we went to see the Village People movie, and when the leather dude got on the, he's in a corporate boardroom, and he gets on the table and he sings Danny Boy. Like the ballad, like with the full feeling and everything. I never forgot that, but I was also so confused. Like, I just didn't know, what's going on? You know?
Right. Oh, that's hilarious. So how about in terms of like, so you're playing trumpet at a pretty young age, your dad's bringing home some kind of mainstream horn records for you to listen to.
Yeah.
You remember like the first record or single that you went out and bought with your money?
When I was really going back even further, I had one of my first records was Billy Joel Glass Houses.
Okay.
And I often think just the other day I was, you know, I watched this documentary I guess it was a Billy Joel documentary. It was a great record. It's like, I've been thinking recently that, I've spent my whole adult life, going as far into jazz as I could, but
yeah.
But it's like, but Billy Joel Glass Houses was a great record, man. You know, it's like.
But he's not holding a trumpet on the cover of that one. That's 52nd Street.
Yeah.
Why is Billy Joel holding a trumpet? I guess it's too hard to hold a piano.
That was one of the Tower Records questions. Because then when I would go through the section, I'd see Billy. Because I wasn't that into Billy Joel, but when I saw him holding the trumpet, I was like, "Wait a minute, is Billy playing on this?
On this
record, you know?"
Yeah.
And then,
you bought Glass Houses.
I remember I had that LP. I had a record player, and I remember I had that LP. This is going back even further.
Sure.
But once I got into jazz, though. Before I worked at Tower, I walked into a Sam Goody, and I asked the guy to just give me a great, because I started playing jazz in the big band in high school.
Okay,
I wanted to check out jazz. So, but I had no direction at all. So I went to Sam Goody and I asked the first guy that I could find. I was like, "Can you give me like the greatest jazz trumpet record that exists?" Uh-huh. You know, because I didn't know anything. And he gave me a this is hilarious for me, because he gave me a cassette of Miles, and Miles had done a record called "You're Under Arrest."
Oh, that was like his experimental kind of. Wasn't like Sting on that?
Yeah, this is like 80s fusion.
Oh my God.
It wasn't the Miles that.
It wasn't classic Miles.
No. This was, and I listened to it and I was like, and I dug it, but I was also like so confused. I was like, so I went back. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, which confused you more, the Village People movie or that Miles record?
I don't know what to call him, the biker dude.
Like, right.
I think
singing Danny dude, Boy.
Pouring his heart out, man. That was, okay. You know.
So where did you have anybody like did your band teacher, could you go to him and ask for recommendation? Who kind of helped lead you down the path to the stuff you ended up really loving?
Well, you know, he played stuff in class. He played a Count Basie thing once that really, I'll never forget it. But what I ended up doing was going to the school library and getting a book about jazz.
Okay.
And I started to teach myself the basics. And I realized "You're Under Arrest" wasn't in the book. I was like, so I went back there. And I can't. And this time the guy gave me Miles' Greatest Hits and Louis Armstrong's Greatest Hits.
Okay.
And now I was cooking, because this was all the classic Miles stuff. Now the Louis Armstrong stuff was not.
It's probably more of his singing stuff, right?
Yeah. It was like
Mac Hello the Dolly. Nice
and yeah. And but on the Louis Armstrong one, there was a blues and he was playing his ass off. This was the first time I ever heard a trumpet player playing like that. And then the Miles Greatest Hit stuff had like live cuts of My Funny Valentine, and it was the pure famous Miles. And that's when I was in really big trouble, because those two cassettes just changed my life forever. I felt the stuff on there so strongly that I decided.
That was like your starting point. Like, all right, this comes from this album. I'm going to get that album and that whole thing. How about a little broader? We can get into more of that stuff in a sec. A little broader. I always say, I realize this is an impossible question, but favorite couple albums of all time, and then your favorite couple artists of all time, say three or four, because I know it changes every day and it could, you know, but if you're to use a tower, you know, thing, if you're on a desert island, what are you taking there with you?
I love that question. I often think about if something would make that list, and there's a few that always come that get to the very top. It's Duke Ellington meets John Coltrane on Impulse.
Okay.
There's this record called, and this is one that you might not expect. It's Elis and Tom. It's Elis Regina meets Tom Jobim. Okay. I think it was called Elis and Tom. And what a just beautiful record, man. The Bossa Nova thing was at full, like, it was a big deal. She was the biggest singer in Brazil. She was like the Billie Holiday of Brazil. They flew her into America to make this record. And there's some stuff about this recording online and all the crazy stuff that happened. But in the end, it just is just unbelievable. And I don't speak Portuguese, but the feeling and the vibe on that record to me has always been I'm a jazz guy, but what really attracts me the most in music is this emotional vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Nina Simone has to, I can't pick a Nina Simone recording. specifically. There's a bunch that I like Nina Sings the Blues, but I'd have to have a Nina Simone record on the island, you know, because she just leaves it all. Yep. She just leaves it all on the line every time.
Yep.
You know, and that's where I try to get through the jazz context, you know, through the jazz environment. I'm trying to get to those to where Nina just always was all the time.
That vulnerability.
Yeah, that's what kills me. And it was when Miles played my funny Valentine live on that cassette, one of the first things I heard, he was like, he wasn't only exposing himself emotionally, which he was also painting this wild abstract shit.
Yeah.
You know. And then later in his life, Miles actually started doing paintings. I could kind of see the connection there.
Yeah.
But if I was on the desert island, I would I'd have to have a Nina record, a Lisa and Tom, Duke Ellington Beach Train, and probably something like Ornette Coleman's like Skies of America or something like that.
Okay. Okay. Good. And then, do you remember? This is a two-parter. Do you remember your first concert? And then give me a couple of the favorite concerts that you've ever seen, that you've ever gone to. Any genre, it's totally up to you.
I mean, the first one that comes to mind as a younger person was B.B. King Live. And okay. I went with my sister. And, you know, like they say, you're in a room and makes the walls sweat. Like the feeling of live blues in the room coming from B.B. King was just the most unbelievable feeling. You know, it's like it never comes through on the records. It, being in the room for me is the real blues experience.
Yeah.
And I got that experience with to see B.B. that one time. You know, and I like his records, but it was nothing like being in the room. I was like right up there in the front, you know.
Do you remember where it was?
You know, it was, I think it was up, it was right up there in the Nanuet area.
Okay.
It was, and he had a full band. He had his son was playing, not his son. Some of his family members were in the band, and I think the trumpet player was related to him somehow.
Okay.
He was a big, heavyset guy, and he was taking solos. And but the vibe was just unreal, you know. I mean, jazz wise, when I was briefly a student at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, I saw a trio called the Fringe, and it was a tenor player named George Garzón, who's he's not super famous or anything. He's definitely more known in the jazz circles, in the jazz community, but seeing him live also was a really pivotal moment. He was doing things that really spoke to me, really changed my direction.
Yeah. Okay, good. And then, so you talked about you're working at a grocery store and you would make trips into New York, and the Village Store and the Village Jazz Department was your destination. At what point do you become aware that there's a store in Nanuet, and how do you decide you're going to apply, and what was the application process like, and how quickly did you get hired? Walk me through all that.
I don't remember how I found out that the Tower Nanuet was there. It must have been, I called up the Village Store. There was also a tower in Paramus, New Jersey. And I forget how I found out about it. It might have even just been from driving by Route 59 and seeing the classic tower sign and being like, wait a minute, there's a tower out here.
Yeah.
You know? And what I do remember is that it was Bill Duffy was the manager. Bill Duffy. This was before Bill. This was way before he became like a regional, became like a big, like way up high in the tower.
He was a store manager.
He was a store manager, but he was a young guy.
Right.
He was a young guy. I mean, I was a lot younger, but he was a young guy. And I don't remember the application that much, except I remember talking to him in the interview was all about jazz.
Okay.
And I think I basically, in the interview, I think I just, he was like, so what's your deal? And I think I didn't know anything about music retail. I didn't know anything at all about that, about how Tower Records worked or right. functioned on a actual level other than being, you know, a fan or a customer of the store.
Yeah.
And I just told him I wanted to be the jazz guy.
Right? Uh-huh.
I'll be your jazz guy, you know? And, I didn't even know what that would entail. I didn't know there would right. be like a jazz buyer or any of that stuff. And he had just hired his jazz buyer. And I forget this guy's name. I forget his name. He had his head shaved and he said, tell you what, I'd like to hire you as a cashier and then try to give you some time in the jazz department. You know, when you're not on the register or maybe a few hours a day, put you in the jazz room. And there was a jazz room at Nanny Wet. Remember on the left side? I mean, you had to open the glass doors and go in there. It was an isolated section. It was, and at that time, the way the CD industry had worked, whether it was Tower's decision or I'm not sure who did it, because it was a new store at that time, they stocked that jazz section to the gills. I mean, they ordered everything.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, this was like even more, this was deeper than the Manhattan store. They went deep on catalogs and they had it all. He was like, well, I'll put you in there to do customer service or whatever needs to be done.
Right.
But you got to do some register time. And I was like, yeah, no problem. So I did the register and, I was okay on register. And I would just, whenever I could, I'd be in there either filing stuff or, you know, and a lot of times the jazz buyer guy wasn't around. If he wasn't around, they put me in there.
Right.
You know, and I'd try to help people in everything. And I, you know, talking to the jazz buyer guy, I could also tell he didn't really know that much about jazz.
Oh, really?
He was like, he knew some basic stuff. Was he more of a smooth
jazz guy?
He really, to me, from what I could tell, he really wasn't a jazz guy. He knew enough to do the basics of what had to go down. You know, he knew how the buying system worked and, he knew about all the technical things about the job, but gotcha. The actual music itself, he wasn't that heavy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but he wasn't going there. He wasn't going anywhere. So eventually, I ended up, in the receiving department with, Kathy Ronenberg, was the receiving head and man, talk about originals, man. This is, you know, there's like characters, characters at Tower, man. Kathy is like, you know, one of the most original, different people I had come across. Like at my life in that time, I wasn't even used to encountering, you know, people that had lived a little while and had, you know, they'd seen some things,
yeah.
They had some experiences and they had become some, you know, first of all, it was a woman running receiving was like stereotypically, you know, a male environment, you know.
Absolutely.
Unloading trucks.
Yep.
You know, like, and Kathy was tough, man. She was real tough. And, but we had a lot of fun though. It was just Kathy, me, and another friend of mine, named Jeff Spindell, who was this, and they're still, I still connected with them on Facebook. And,
nice.
And Jeff was another just off the wall character. He's kind of like a School of Rock kind of guy.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
But really, and we had a lot of fun. I mean, you know, and I learned the basics of a receiving. You know, nice. I can't remember the name of the computers. I don't remember. Was it not GERS? I forget the programs. But right. You know,
yeah.
It was. I learned about. I remember the accessory doing the accessory.
Uh-huh.
When the accessories came in, receiving them, and then, but I was only the receiving manager for a few months when I had decided personally that I needed to move to New York City to pursue my jazz life.
Well, let me before we get to that, let me just ask you real quickly.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about. So I realize you're mostly in receiving and stuff, but just tell me otherwise about the vibe of the Nanuet store. I've always heard that the Long Island stores are tough, especially with the customers and stuff. But just generally, you know, I also look at stores like Tower or any other stores that go into the suburbs as kind of an oasis for people that aren't like everybody else. Some of the best Tower stores I went to were in the Virginia suburbs, which I never worked at, just I'd be on my time off. But tell me a little bit about that store and the vibe of it and how it connected with the locals.
Well, you know, it's like you said, you know, like just walking in there, I felt like I was more in an environment, just a kind of, it's like you walk in there and it's just a place that makes sense to me. I'm connected to the music by being in the store.
Right.
You know, like, and I can talk to people about, you know, things like Charlie Parker or whatever it is.
Right.
You know, I just, you know, so being able to just talk to people like that always felt really good. And that it was a hip store. It was, uh-huh. it was a very hip store. And Bill was so cool that, he let me do in-store performances there.
Okay.
And, I did two of them and he let me do it. He let me promote the hell out of it. And we set up the room and I did two of those. And I actually have photos of some of that stuff.
Nice.
And, you know, and Nanuet was, and Nanuet is suburbia, but it was also close enough to the city.
Right.
That people from the New York City scene would be in there.
Okay.
And it was kind of like being a little part of both worlds at the same time. It was like, so it was almost like you're in suburbia, but you still had a little bit of street cred. The city was right there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was a trumpet player named Darren Barrett who sat in on one of my in-stores, and he had already been doing the New York thing, and he was way better than me, and he absolutely destroyed me on my own in-store. I was like, yeah, he played trumpet. He played so good. He just blew me off the, you know, the stage, and which was cool. But it also reminded me that New York is right there.
Yeah.
And next door to Tower was Barnes & Noble. And there's a great alto player named Bruce Williams who worked there. And we became friends by seeing each other around working at the two stores.
Right.
And Bruce today is one of the, he's one of the great jazz musicians of today. He's working constantly. He teaches, and he is one of the premier alto sax musicians playing today in the New York area.
Nice.
And Bruce played with me on the in-stores.
Okay.
Which was cool.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was hit, man. A couple memories that stand out from that store for me was somehow I didn't get the, I don't know how it happened, but it was time for inventory. And somehow I just did not know. And it, like, no one had told me. I didn't see the signs that were posted. I thought, I didn't know what inventory was. Okay. And I didn't know. And then I didn't know it was going down. So I came in one day at the regular time and I seen everybody already there going through the bins. Like everybody's doing inventory. I didn't know what was going on. I was like, and Tim came over and he was pissed. And he was pissed.
Tim.
And he was like, not Tim. I'm thinking of Tim Devin. Bill was like, what's up, man? I was like, I didn't get the memo.
Uh-huh.
But you're supposed to be there at 6 and ready to go. And everybody's kind of looking at me like, wow, this guy, uh-huh. he thinks he can just stroll in like whatever. But he was like, you didn't know. I was like, honestly, man, I wouldn't just strut in here like this if everybody was supposed to be here at 6. And he was like, all right. He looked at me weird, but he kind of let it go. And I was on point with everything else, but I always remember that thing of walking in and everybody's already working and looking at me like I'm a jerk.
Right.
You know? And that wouldn't be my first, that wasn't my first negative inventory experience. Later on in New York, something would go down.
Yeah.
But that memory, that's one thing that I always remembered.
Yeah.
And, but also silly stuff. There was also this time in receiving, but one of the security guys, I forget his name. He had a giant glass jar of really bad smelling cologne. And he dropped it right in the middle of the receiving area, which was on like a pavement kind of floor.
Right, right.
So it broke and it left this stain. And no matter what we did, we could not get the stain off or get the smell out of the receiving area.
Yeah.
And it was always it was a funny thing.
Yeah.
It's funny, especially looking back.
Sure.
You know? But it was just a silly, ridiculous.
Yeah.
Memory that stuck in my head, you know.
So
we had a lot of fun more than anything else.
Yeah. So you made the decision that you needed to go into the city. So well, did you, oh, go ahead.
The one other life changing thing that happened was at Tower Nanuet was that I met two older musicians there, two older jazz guys there. That became lifelong collaborators and friends. It was like Tom Cabrera was a drummer and he was working there. He was more like a cashier, I think.
Uh-huh.
And Jack DeSalvo was still is a guitar player and he was the classical buyer.
Okay.
And now here were some real bona fide jazz guys that had way more life experience than me. And they're working at Tower. Like me.
Right.
And I'm like the new jazz guy, but we started playing together and we actually used to, on a break, we used to actually sit up we used to go out the receiving door into like the back parking lot behind the store and we used to play. And we did that a number of times. So we would spend our break having a jam session in the parking lot behind the store. And I've remained friends with those guys to this day.
Oh, that's amazing. That sounds like something you'd see in a movie or something.
And years later, we actually recorded the trio and we called the project Sumari. And we've recorded, and then as the music industry changed with Bandcamp and everything, we've probably made 4 or 5 recordings by now.
Okay, cool.
And that Samari actually got 4 stars in Downbeat.
Nice.
Which was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And it all started at Tower. It's all because of Tower Records.
That's amazing. So tell me about the decision to go into the city and how you ended up at Lincoln Center for the first time.
Well, I knew as a, especially from talking to Jack, who had already spent really done some years in New York as a jazz musician, that I had to go really to become a better jazz musician. I had to be in that environment. And it's kind of like a thing that all jazz musicians have to do.
Sure.
I mean, back then more than now, but I mean, New York was the jazz capital, jazz center of the universe. Right. You know, what it is now is debatable. But at the time, New York was still the center, and CDs hadn't reached full power, but CDs were at that time starting to really become serious money. And so I was like, well, how am I gonna get to New York? Well, I just ask Villa if I can transfer to either store, the Village or Lincoln Center.
Right.
And it turned out Lincoln Center had a spot in receiving as a clerk. And so Tower made it possible for me to make the move. And I moved to the Jersey City YMCA, which was really a whole other story in itself.
Yeah.
And that's how I first got there.
Okay.
And then I would take the PATH train to Lincoln Center, and my boss's name was Hammer. It was John Hammer.
Okay.
And he was a tough guy too. He was kind of like this tough. He had this vibe. He had like this tough vibe, but he didn't really talk that much. He just had this vibe. Uh-huh. He would only say stuff if he had to. Otherwise he would just, but I always felt his, it's like, you always felt like you had to watch out for Hammer.
Right.
Like he might
explode.
He might explode or something. But he never did.
Yeah.
And we were always cool. And my boss is over there. My boss there was Eric Feigner.
Okay.
Come to find out that he had a twin brother who was running the Village Store, the Feigner brothers.
Yes. Was it John? John was the other?
I think so.
Yeah, I think it's Eric and John. Yeah.
And Eric, yeah, and they were running and there was another tower on the east side. There was a third tower on the Upper East Side, and there was also Tower Outlet, which was near the Village Store.
And there was Trump Tower.
And of course, there was Trump Tower. Yeah.
Wow.
And so I was at the Lincoln Center store as a clerk. But worked my way eventually. I forget how, but I worked my way up to being the receiving head.
Okay.
I think Hammer left, or Hammer went to a different department, and I just went for it, and Eric gave me a shot, and I was the receiving manager there for a while.
Okay.
And that's when I really, really got pretty heavy into doing that, because CDs were just, I mean, there was so much business going down.
Oh yeah. People rebuying their entire collections. And I mean, I'm always amazed at the way people diss CDs, and there's stuff to be dissed about, but just the sheer amount of stuff that came out of the vaults during those years. I'm just now going through my entire CD collection. I'm uploading everything. I'm getting rid of stuff, just trying to, you know, but I look at, and you could tell better than anyone, just the sheer amount of jazz stuff that came out, was unbelievable. Unbelievable. And then you take that to folk and rock and world and God knows classical, and your point is exact. It was there was a lot of money being made.
I mean, I'll never forget the unloading those trucks
Yeah.
And getting that stuff downstairs and the whole process. And there was so much going down and we only had so much room to work with.
Uh-huh.
And we had to just make the room. And I remember I had stuff stacked up everywhere. And yeah. it got to the point where this one Christmas, Eric came out and said, unlimited overtime for anyone that wants it during, from Thanksgiving to New Year's, you could actually work every day and
just rack up the overtime.
And there was no limit. And because the work was there, always, even on the weekends, there was still stuff to be done.
Sure.
And I remember I took him up on it and I did something like 30 days straight.
Oh my God.
And I had an agenda, which was that I was going to take I was trying to buy a new Bach trumpet. That's exactly what I did.
I was going to jokingly say, I bet you bought an instrument with it.
That was exactly my plan. And then after New Year's, I went right down to Sam Ash in Midtown and I bought a brand new Bach for $3,000 or something like that.
Wow.
I had made all that money doing overtime.
And by the way, did you see the announcement that store is closing?
Oh man, I just saw it.
That got announced today.
Yeah. And in fact, I ended up working there at that store for like another 10 years after the tower.
Oh, wow. Wow. Wow.
So that store that's closing is I worked at that store for a long time.
Yeah.
So like it's a whole other, all these things are,
yeah,
you know, so I worked at Tower literally to the end.
And, yeah.
Now that Sam Ash, at a certain point I tapped out, but now they're actually going. But Sam Ash is not going down, but they're closing 20 stores.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And New York, we've
seen the movie. We know how it ends.
Exactly.
And so tell me, I mean, I know you're mostly in receiving at this time, but, you know, a definite point could be made that the jazz department in Lincoln Center certainly rivaled the downtown store.
Yeah.
Obviously classical was king, but that jazz. So were you, you know, in your time not in receiving, you're either shopping or out on the sales floor and stuff, were you running into heroes of yours at all or anything like that, or? People you knew or looked up to, or what was
well,
that?
You know,
like?
on that period of Tower, I was kind of isolated. There was so much to do in receiving.
Okay,
I didn't really get to too much out there onto the jazz floor.
Okay,
I wanted to, and my own jazz career, which would exist after work,
right,
was also in a real state of confusion and flux. I was running into a lot of obstacles in that side of my life.
Okay.
And questioning what kind of, you know, I didn't really know what my own music was going to be like, and I was going through that kind of thing.
Sure.
And my connection to jazz was kind of like truncated, or kind of like, you know,
yeah,
it was more about the work,
yeah,
than anything else, which is regrettable, because I ended up going back upstate.
Okay.
Like trying to figure out, you know, like some kind of like an identity crisis about what it is I'm actually doing.
Okay.
You know, I had run into the straight. I was only on the straight ahead conservative scene, musically in New York. And it wasn't going anywhere. Like, gotcha. It wasn't happening. And, the Tower thing was all good. You know, and I could have stayed in the city, but I decided to, you know, and there may or may not have been a girlfriend involved that I had to go. had to go upstate.
Isn't that how it always is?
You know, sometimes, yeah. there may or may not have been some kind of female situation going on.
Sure.
But, and I shouldn't say it that way, because now you can't, I'll just say there was relationship.
Sure. Issues. I got you. I understand what you mean.
And, but
you left for a couple years and then came back.
Right. But before I left though, and this is really a big thing for me is there was a guy in the classical department named Francois, and he was looking to do overtime. So they sent him to receiving. And that's when I first met him. Now this guy, Francois, was a bass player, and he insisted, he kept telling me that he could play and I should hire him for gigs and stuff. And eventually I did, and we became really good friends. He became one of my main musical collaborators for a long, long time.
Right.
But when I left, Francois took the receiving head position. As I left, he took it.
Gotcha.
So this is the fun part for me, because okay, I go upstate, yada yada. Like two or three years, I'm gonna come back to the city. And of course, who do I turn to? Tower.
Yeah.
First thing I did was I took a trip down to the city from Kingston, New York. Now I was up in the New Paltz, Kingston area. And I visited Francois at the Tower and told him I wanted to come. I was thinking about coming back. He got me an interview with Tim Devin. As I recall, Tim was like, "You're on." He was like, "You can be a receiving clerk." And I had a friend, I had another friend named Ryan Sawyer, gave me a room in Queens. And now I'm back in the city and I'm back at Tower again. And now Francois is my boss, because.
Gotcha. Right. Right.
I was his supervisor. Now he's my supervisor.
Right.
In receiving.
Yeah.
So this is like my favorite period of working at Tower.
Okay.
And eventually this is where you and I met.
Yeah.
So now Francois ends up getting fired for various reasons.
Okay.
Francois gets fired.
For the reasons that receiving clerks get fired.
Yes. Okay. Exactly.
That's the best way to put it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And it had something to do with the cleans. Something to do with cleans. Like all that, the cleans thing was a whole racket unto itself.
So last time when we first started the podcast, we would explain these things.
Yeah.
And I realized we had an episode recently and somebody posted, "What are cleans?" So just for people who don't know, cleans are CDs that are provided by the record company. They're not promotional. A rep comes in and there's 25 of the same title. They're not marked. They can be sold. They're literally currency in the record business. So if a rep brings in 25 CDs, well, their base cost is $11. Take 11 times 25, and you've got a box worth $300 there that people and Tower would accommodate. We would receive them for free, and then that sales rep would get that credit on their account, or they would share it with a manager or a buyer or however they wanted to do it. And in some cases, it wasn't just a box of 25, it was boxes of 25 and et cetera. So for those who don't know what cleans are, and really the only person, I should say the person really getting screwed is the artist whose cleans they've decided, because that's legally pulled from their recording contract. It's this nefarious clause in their recording contract that they can, the record company, do a specific amount of promotional things, or unlimited, I think, and cleans, and nobody thinks about it when they're signing it, but they're basically paying for that. So anyway, go ahead about, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and as the receiving manager, I was the guy that processed cleans for everybody.
Right.
Including Tim. So,
yeah.
You know, people would come into my desk and put a stack down and I'd have to receive it, and then they could turn that into cash.
Yeah.
Or
Well, not so much cash, but credit on their account.
Yeah, credit. Yeah, and then you'd be like, and I had my own stack of cleans. I don't remember if I received my own cleans or not, but I remember this thing with cleans was a big deal. And as the jazz buyer, Francois was, he had so many cleans. He had, and he didn't trade, he didn't necessarily trade them all in. He was at home. He was building an incredible music collection with stuff that was being given to him as a jazz buyer.
Right.
And I don't remember exactly what happened, but he did go down on something went astray.
Right.
With the cleans.
Probably something didn't go by the book.
Yeah. Yeah. I forget what it was. And Francois was out, which was regrettable because he was my buddy.
Right.
But now I went back into the head of receiving because Francois left.
Yeah.
So now I was head of receiving again.
Gotcha.
You know, and this was a lot different because this is when I had a great crew of guys and we got to really know each other. We had a lot of fun in the cage, as we called it. And remember Victor Vasquez? I'm still friends with him. Vic's a great guy. I still talk to him on Facebook. I ran into him on the subway once. There was Sandro Salone.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
He was employee of the month once, and we always had a lot of fun. One day we almost really got into it or something, but we worked it out. And there was a guy named John Noto, and everybody loved Noto. There was this other like heavy metal kind of guy. I forget his name. Was in the pricing department. There was Jose.
Yep.
I mean, this guy's another, we're talking about these extreme original, they're all real originals. And I can kind of see the other people in pricing, but I can't remember their names too well.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of fun. And, you know, most of us, if not all of us, were all younger people.
Yep.
You know, trying to figure life out.
Sure. Hey, I actually have a question for you because you came back to Lincoln Center in 99. Did you, and this is something, it's funny because I've interviewed Tim and I've interviewed Christina Sharp and Ryan Bland, and I don't think I've asked anybody this question. It's something I thought about later, but did you work in the store on 9/11?
I did.
What are your memories of that? Because that's a question I should have asked everyone who worked in New York City.
Actually, the tower is the focus of my memory that day because I was
it was a big new release day. People don't remember that. Yeah. It was a Tuesday.
I'm actually a little bit embarrassed by the whole thing because I was in receiving and the guys were up on the street getting a big delivery from UPS, like a multi it was gonna take more than one trip.
Uh-huh.
And we were pretty busy. And Tim came into the cage and he came over to me and he looked kind of like
concerned.
And he goes, he said a plane just hit one of the towers. And I didn't believe it.
Uh-huh.
I was like, what? I was like, I mean, I was working or whatever, but I was like, it must be like an accident or like,
right.
I was doubtful. I was like,
yeah. Or like me, I, we heard about it and it's like, oh, it must've been one of those small little commuter planes.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Yeah. I was like, oh, like one or two people or something like that.
Right.
And he goes, no, man. He goes, come to my office. And I went to his office and he had it on and he had a live video of, one of the towers on fire, like with the fire and everything.
Wow.
And I was like, what? I was like, you know, like, what the hell, man?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I guess I tried to go back to work or whatever. Next thing you know, both towers had fallen and it was, you know, the absolute worst of 9/11 was in effect. But we were not closed yet you know, there were still people shopping. There were people that had no idea what went down.
Yep.
And what none of us knew was that the city was being shut down all around us. Everything was being shut down. The subways, the buses, tunnels. But tunnels, everything was being shut down. And we stayed open till like noon or one. But the information started to come in. And I remember Adam Barrientos, actually, this makes me a little emotional, man. This Adam Barrientos was in receiving, and he got a call from his girlfriend at the time, and she was on the subway, but the subway had stopped in between. She was kind of like stuck on the subway between stops.
Oh,
and she was with. I think they had like a newborn son or a child or something. And she called Adam, and Adam was like, I got to go.
Right. Right.
And I was like, of course, you know, and he split to go try to help his lady trapped in the subway and everything. And that was the kind of thing that was going on. People were like, I got to, you know, and people started disappearing there was a giant pallet of stuff to be unloaded. Oh man, I was like, what am I gonna, you know, I long story short, well,
you don't realize the enormity of what you're in the middle of. You're thinking of what's directly in front of you.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember hearing all this stuff, and it wasn't until I got a call from a friend, and he goes, you know, your sister works at World Trade. And unbelievably, I didn't. I knew she worked in the city. I didn't know she worked down there, you know. Yeah. And at that point, I was like, I'm out of here. I got to go figure, you know. And then someone said, you can't get into the city, you know. Anyway, you're concentrated on what's in front of you until you realize the enormity of it.
Well, and eventually we all realized we're closing and there's no way to get home. You're on your own and getting in runs, and how are you going to get back to wherever you live? I lived in Jackson Heights, Queens.
Okay.
So like millions of other people, I walked across town and then walked across the 59th Street Bridge, which was closed. And there was, I don't say millions, but thousands of us walking across the 59th Street Bridge. You're watching the jets go by, you know. it was full force 9/11. I remember it took me about 2.5 or 3 hours to get back to Jackson Heights just on foot. At a certain point, I got a ride. At a certain point, I jumped in a van with a whole bunch of strangers that was just going in the same direction.
Yeah.
And I always remember that. I don't know if it was the next day. We were back open for business pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if it was the next day or the day after, but I remember the city put the city restored the subway system, and they decided the city could go back to business, back to work. I don't remember how many days that lasted.
Yeah.
But I always remember being back at work, and everybody was there, and a whole bunch of us were standing around looking at each other, like kind of, you know, like all kind of shocked and a little scared.
Yeah.
And I remember no one was saying nothing. So I broke the tension because a really good friend of mine from back then, named Craig Brooks, was a good friend of mine back then. And I was like, yo, Craig, I was talking to him, but everybody was listening because there was so much people around. I was like, yo, man, I was like, you're on a plane, and these guys come out and they're telling you they're taking over the plane, you know, and all they got is a box cutter. I was like, what are you gonna do? And Craig was like, he made the motion like take the box cutter away from the guy and then hit the guy and then use the box cutter on the guy to fight back, you know. And then everybody, you know, everybody was just kind of like laughing, but seriously, like, you know, we kind of like broke the broke tension. Broke the tension, but I also remember being shook that everybody had to go back to work and it was back to business as usual.
Yeah.
You had to be on, that was the job, we had to receive. We had to bring in the stuff and the one thing I'll never forget from receiving is the returns, man. The monthly return was such a big deal, man.
Oh, yeah.
And I really took that upon myself as in my whole tower experience. When I was the head of receiving, I took the return almost like my own personal thing, because I had to put it together, make the paperwork, get it on the truck, and get it out of there. And I this was like something I took kind of personal.
Right, right.
To make it go down. And every month we did a lot of the scanning our stuff. Not there was other people that would scan their stuff out and we'd set them up. But I had to number the boxes.
Yep.
There was no room. There was no room. So I would have stacks in the hallway, stacks down by your office, stacks everywhere. And getting them numbering them, getting the labels on there, and getting them out was something else. And as soon as
it went out, you had to start working on the following month.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I'd never forget the returns, man. And I'd seen pictures of the warehouse where all the returns go.
Yeah.
And I just can't even imagine. Like these trucks pulled up and then they had to, this is what CDs were king. CDs were king during that period.
Yeah.
And the money that was going down, because I used to do the printout at the end of the return, I did the printout with those printers that were always having problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'd be like this thick with the detail of everything went down. And I'd always go to the last page and circle it. And
$388,000 going back.
I'd go to Tim or yourself, and I'd give you the numbers. I'd say, here's it, just so you know, here's what went down this month.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I had some kind of bulletin that I gave to all the buyers, like giving them a breakdown of the whole thing.
Oh, that's yeah, yeah.
And but eventually, I forget who was the jazz buyer, but the jazz buyer thing opened up.
Yep.
And I don't remember who was. It was an older lady, maybe. I can't remember. But I remember Tim had left, and you had stepped in as manager.
Right.
And I remember I applied for, I wanted to, once that, now it's like a bookend of my whole thing.
Right.
I still wanted to be the jazz buyer.
Yeah, yeah.
After all these years, I was like, well, maybe I can, I still want to do it.
Yeah.
If I can. And then you let me have a shot.
Yep. Yep. And you did an incredible job. It's so funny because I specifically remember you were on the job for a little while, and I remember you had a new release book in your hand, and it wasn't Kenny G. It may have been Kenny G, but it was something. And you're like, oh man, I can't believe these major labels are putting out this crap. This is unbelievable. This is what people are coming in and buying, and it's not the real thing, and it's da da da. And I remember saying to you, Kenny G pays for the Louis Armstrong reissues.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of some of the other but this thing pays for the Coltrane reissues.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh,
right,
okay, it was all kind of making sense in your head, like if this jazz department of a label is having a killer time, it's a lot easier to raise the money to put out, the really good stuff.
Yeah.
But you did some incredible stuff. That you had a regular in-store series.
Well, see, man, that was one of the real pinnacles of my whole time experience. And I have to give thanks to you for setting that up.
Actually, you need to thank, because I think Bart Greenberg was the first one to do it with his cabaret series.
That's right.
He started it, and it was just really well executed and received and got press and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And you, I remember you coming to me like a month later going, hey, is this something we could do with jazz? I'm like, plan it and make it run, you know, let's do it. And you did, you did just as good a job putting it together and having it. It was a very cool jam session.
How was that piano? It was actually a stand up piano there.
Didn't we have some sort of trade? Again, I think Bart set it up. There was some kind of trade with like one of the top piano rental companies. And so that at every in-store it said like, you know, rental piano furnished by, and I can't remember the name of the company. And we got free use of a piano, you know what I mean? A top-notch piano. And I think they came in like once a month or once every 2 months and tuned it. And yeah.
I mean, having an actual piano there is just, and then I forgot, man, I forget about Bart, man. I hope he's doing well. And I mean, I remember he had like his cabaret
series. He had that cabaret series that kind of kicked it off. Yeah.
And then we had a little sound system.
Yep.
Then the art department got involved. And one of the photos that I sent you, I have the sign for Patrizia. I'll pronounce her name wrong, but she was a great Italian jazz piano player that did it in the store there. And it was booked. We did it for at least a year. I had it booked for another year when things started falling apart.
Yeah, yeah.
But trying to remember. Oh, yeah, and you also had it catered. Was it like this place called Balducci's?
Balducci's. Yeah, I remember. Tim said when I took over the store, they had a sign right in the like prime real estate, and I'm like, what's the deal with that? Why do you guys have that? And he goes, we have that sign in there. He goes, and we get $500 a month in free catering. So when we had, you know, supervisor meetings, they would eat well, and when we would have buyers meetings, they would eat well, and then for things like your events, you know, we could do food and stuff. It was, I'll tell you, man, one of the things Tower taught me and talking to a number of the people who did like the mobile marketing positions, Tower perfected the art of the trade. We'll give you this real estate in our store and you give us blank. And that was a perfect example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember going to Balducci's before the events and getting the stuff.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this was really, man, this was, you know, and I remember thinking at the time, I was like, and, you know, and I would be in a lot of the performances.
Uh-huh.
So then I was like saying to myself, do I punch out? I was like, no, I'm actually, I never asked you your official take on it, but I was like, do I punch out on that? I'm going to be like, you know, then I was like, but no, this is, I'm at work.
You're spreading the gospel.
I'm at work. So it was like, you know.
How about any of the stuff that happened on the sales floor? Now that you're officially the jazz guy, I remember one time. So we did the one thing that we haven't talked about is we made the decision. I don't know if you were, I never knew who was happy and who was mad at any particular point, but we made the decision to move jazz into the basement and video upstairs, which I to this day, having worked at other retailers, I can't believe we did that in 12 hours.
That was unreal, man.
John Graham, you know, planned that thing so well on his end. And then, you know, just everybody. And I always tell people, all we needed was for that elevator to break down for an hour or two and we were screwed.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we made that complete change. But you're, so jazz is in the basement at a certain point. I always remember when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar would be shopping in the store because you could see him from a mile away. And then I remember walking through one time and Tony Bennett stops me. He's like, yeah, can you help me look for this movie? And I'm like, yeah, let's go find it for you. You know, like,
yeah.
So, or was that, he was looking for a jazz music video or something, but yeah,
he was always, Kareem was always very cool.
Yeah.
Like if you left, like if you gave him his space, exactly. And just talked about jazz.
Yeah.
He was cool. Anyone that was even thinking about going over, I was like, don't go over there on some basketball shit.
Exactly.
I was like, just, you know, don't
fuck jazz with him.
You gotta be cool. You gotta be cool.
Yeah.
And,
anybody else that you dealt with?
Well, actually, that leads me to my number one tower story.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
But just before I say that one, I am remiss to not say that in my previous tower experience, we had to move the whole store.
Oh, yeah.
Up to the Ansonia building. And I forgot about this, and I'll never forget. Everybody was standing there the morning of the first day. The store was closed. We had to do the move ourselves. It wasn't like a moving company. All the employees had to do the move, and I'll never forget that first morning. I didn't know Tim was going to do this. Tim had the whole staff together, and we hadn't even begun. And Tim goes, "Matt Lavelle is in charge of moving everything uptown." And I was like, I didn't know. You know, I was like, whoa. I didn't say nothing. I was like, okay. I took it really seriously.
Yeah.
And we went hard. The same kind of thing, switching floors around.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing. But it went out for 2 weeks, man. We didn't do overnights.
I was in the middle of the day.
It was right in the middle of the day. And we had 18-wheelers. We had an 18-wheeler in front of the store. We would load it up and send everything up at... It was all kind of a blur.
Yeah.
But what a crazy 2 weeks, man. We worked hard. We worked hard on that.
Yeah.
It was like real.
Yeah.
But that's just something that I had
you remembered, yeah.
Remembered. But when I came back, so one morning I got to the store. This is my ultimate Tyler Rivers experience. You know, we had the glass doors. Those you can see everything at the front door. The total of glass, you can see through. When you come in, you know, someone will open the door for you. You go in, they lock the door.
Right.
You know, we're bringing the staff in, but no
right.
customers.
Right.
So I had just gotten in. The door was locked, and I was getting ready to go downstairs, and there was a customer who was pressing his face into the glass, like morphing his face into the glass. And he had on a really tight hoodie. And he was going, "Come on, man. Come on. Give me a break. Come on, man. You got to let me in, man. Come on." And I was like, so my initial impression was, this is some crazy homeless dude. I'm just going to tell him to beat it.
Right.
So I went over to tell him to get lost. And then when I got, I looked at him like really close, I was like, this is Robin Williams, right? I was like, screw it. I was like, I'll open the door, let him in, close the door. And I didn't even know what he wanted. You know, I was like, it's Robin Williams.
The way I heard it was that it was the day of a Jay-Z release, and his son, he was getting it for his son or something.
Yeah. Yeah. He was looking for some obscure hip hop.
Okay.
And he wanted me to help him find it. And I had never heard of it. And it was for his son. And there could have been a Jay-Z thing.
Yeah.
But I remember he had these two things on a piece of paper. And hip hop was not my section, but I was like, we gotta try. I was like, we gotta go for it. There's nobody else around.
Right.
I don't know if we had a real there wasn't like a real hip hop expert on the floor. It was early. So I went over there and really was like going hard in there to try and hook this up. But while I was doing it, I was like, I'm gonna take this up, this insane opportunity to talk to him.
Right.
Because it's just me and him.
Right, right.
you know? And because eventually, he wasn't on that, like, Showtime stuff anymore. Eventually, he was just kind of like a regular person. Uh-huh. And I was, like, talking to him about, and sometimes around celebrities, I say the dumbest things. And I was like, I asked him, and I asked him, I was like, what's my favorite Robin Williams film? And I think back, I was like, that's such a dumb thing to say. I'm like, I'm going to ask Robin Williams, what's my favorite Robin Williams film? And, but he wasn't fazed by it. He was like, okay. He goes, Fisher King. And I was like, nah, that's not it. He was like, nah, it wasn't Fisher King, huh? Uh-huh. I was like, nah, bro. He was like, something else. And I was like, nah, man. And then he goes, and then I told him it was Awakenings, which was this, this drama, which I, man, Awakenings kills me to this
day. Yeah, with De Niro.
Yeah. I was like, Awakenings, man. I was like, and then when I said that, his whole vibe really changed. He got really emotional. Hmm. And he was like, oh man. He goes, that really means something to me, man. Like he seemed to be really genuinely touched by that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And I wasn't just trying to say the right thing. I really loved that film.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I couldn't find the stuff that he was looking for.
Oh man.
I think he decided to get, he got something anyway. And, you know, I helped him get it rung up. And, you know, that was one and only time I would ever see him, much less get to talk to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Know? But then there was another time that Elton John came in and he had these two security guys. And one guy was wearing, these were big dudes.
Yeah.
One security dude was wearing a yellow suit and the other guy was wearing a purple suit. And what they would do is they blocked off the aisle so that Elton could shop. So they went from section to section and wouldn't allow anybody to get near him.
Interesting.
But he would shop. But then when people outside of the security area would be like, Elton, he would turn and he'd smile and he'd wave.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, it's Elton. You know, it was having a ball that. Yeah. People just going crazy that he was waving at them.
Right, right.
You know, and I always thought how cool that was that he had his security so personalized. And effective.
They knew exactly what to do.
And then when he rung out, he had a huge basket of stuff and he had some kind of like metal, like black metal American Express. It was like, whoa, you
know? Right, right. Went right through.
And there could be other things I'm forgetting, but the Robin Williams thing was tops for me, man.
How about so kind of as we wrap it up here, you mentioned some of the guys that worked with you on your floor are no longer with us. Ken Robertson, George Janitas. Like when I think of Tower characters, those guys are pretty high up on the list.
And for me, the biggest one of all is Francois himself.
Okay.
So Francois is such a long time personal friend. I mean, really one of my best friends for decades because of Tower, passed away a couple years ago in his early 60s. Mm. And Francois, I had heard that George passed away. And George, man, I mean, you know, like you said, can there be more of it? He was such a character that I gave him his own in-store event.
Uh-huh.
And he delivered a sermon. He like
it was after we had, so do you remember somebody made up CDs of the thing?
Oh really?
I literally just came across it like in the last month.
Yeah.
But I remember you did that. It was after, so we weren't owned by Tower anymore. We were owned by that lousy company. And I remember, and I didn't walk because I remember walking through Chaz, and he was like you said, he was basically giving a sermon, and it was, I was like, oh my God, you know, I was like rolling my eyes, like, oh my God, George is on the top of his game, like he's got an audience, he is not going to let them go, But I got to listen to that CD because I know he was out there. But I love that guy. I mean, just so many great people. So many great people at that store.
I mean, George, I never knew the real story of what his life was before he ended up there. But he always had on that jacket.
Yep.
And he took it really serious.
Yep.
And his message was love.
Yeah. Yeah.
His message was love. And then his adversary was Tubman Aunt Namora was this big, bald, Creole dude.
Uh-huh.
And played electric bass. And him and George were just at war all the time. On some car. My other favorite was Mike Scott, man. Mike Scott. Like you know how you're saying, I was like, oh, I can't believe they don't, you know, talking about Kenny G and all this
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mike was like the militant version of me, uh-huh. who was never gonna accept Kenny G
right
on any level. Like he right. was on. And his brother Noel Scott was in the Sun Ra Orchestra in Philly.
Oh wow!
And Mike was so rough on customers, and it seemed like. And I tried to talk to him about it, but there were a few moments when there was like nothing I could do. Like I would come on the scene after everything had gone down. Like at this one time, somebody asked Mike, "Where's the?" I don't know if it was Kenny G, but. You know, yeah. Where's the so-and-so section? And Mike goes, I don't have time for that shit. He goes, that music is bullshit and I don't have no time for that. And he walked away. And the customer was like, what the hell? Okay.
Right, right, right.
I mean, rightfully so. I was just walking over as it was. And the customer was like, I didn't know. He was like, I didn't come here to be judged. He was like, I don't come here to spend my money to be vilified for my musical choices. And yeah. I was like, you're absolutely right. You know, I forget how we squashed it, but I remember I was like, no man, I was like, I'm sorry about that. You're right. I was like, everybody respects
yep.
everybody's personal things there, you yep. know. And you know, I have my thing about
sure
about jazz, but I would, you know, I would never
put it on someone else. Yeah,
flip it on a or right. especially on a customer.
Yeah, yeah,
that's a quick way to get canceled in these days.
Yeah,
you know. But Mike was but Mike would never. He was just so hardcore.
Yeah,
and you know, there was one time. I went to the bathroom by receiving, and somebody was in the stall throwing themselves against the walls of the stall, like you know, like boom, like literally bouncing themselves off the wall like violently. And I was like, what the hell, man? And then Mike came out. He was like, but he was cool. He was like back. He went in there and did wow. like some kind of like got rid of anger or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah, yeah.
And then when he came out, he was cool. He had like whatever it was, he let it go.
Wow.
You know, and I was like, whoa, man, this guy's got a sword. Like really like
yeah.
truly yeah. hardcore.
Yeah.
You know, and then, there's, I know we're definitely headed towards the end of the story.
Yeah.
Actually, the next person I remember is part of the end. So the liquidation begins.
Right.
You know, happened very, the whole thing happened so quickly.
Yep.
For me, I was like, because I was, not, there was no way I was going to believe that. I had heard that Tower was in trouble. I was like, whatever, it's not going right. to happen. You can't close Tower Records, man.
Right. Yep.
Tower Records, you can't close us, man. We're Tower. I was like, yeah, the industry's changed, but I was telling people Tower's going to adapt. We'll figure this out. But then all of a sudden, it was awesome. I think there was a sign on the clock.
Oh yeah.
The door.
Oh yeah.
The sign was like, this is it, and we found out. The liquidators were on their way.
Yep.
And this couple from Texas showed up.
His name was Michael Jackson. I remember he gave me his business card. Oh. It was him and his wife.
Yeah. What a twisted irony, man.
The only reason I remember it is because I'm like, this old white guy, his name Michael Jackson, and he's going to,
And I will never forget that couple coming in, and I remember him announcing to whoever was in the area that he was like, whatever y'all think this is, everything here belongs to me. He was like saying, everything here is mine. Like he was like pointing at everything. And everybody was like, and I remember he did this thing about, he goes, here's the deal. You could stay or you could go. If you want to go, cool. Otherwise, you work for me now, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were like, peace.
Yeah. I'm out.
And then he found out, he was like, so I didn't know what to do, but I didn't have another job. So I decided to take out the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And of course he was like, oh, you're the receiving guy. So the first thing he said to me was, he goes, you do consignments, right? I was like, yeah. He goes, call every one of your consignments and tell them they're not getting their stuff back. It belongs to me. So I had over 200 consignments.
Yeah.
And he was like that. So the first thing I thought of was that he was really playing a dangerous game, mainly because one of the people that I had on consignment was a bona fide gangster. He was a rapper, but on his actual life, this guy was a serious street guy.
Oh wow!
He was a rapper named Maximum Grime.
Okay.
And I had met him. I consigned his stuff in the store, and he did sell. And he was a great rapper. And I actually, he hired me for some trumpet stuff to do on his records.
Uh-huh.
And I play on some of his recordings. And in the little bit of time that I hung out with him, I saw his life, which was big money, but this was a seriously dangerous cat. This was a bona fide gangster. Not like he wasn't just rapping about gangster stuff. This guy was a gangster.
Okay.
But the story doesn't have a bad ending though. It's actually got a good one because first thing I did was I called Max and I said, Max, there's a couple here from Texas. They say that all your stuff belongs to them. And to make it worse, Maximum Grime's mom had written a book and I consigned the book. And I had a box of these books that his mom wrote. He said, what? I said, man, you better come down here right now, man, or if you want to get your stuff back. And he goes, I forget what he said, but he hung up and he came right to the store and he came right back to receiving. And he was like, yo, what's up? You know, like, and I was like, go down that hallway right there. And at the end of the hallway is Michael Jackson. Right? He was like, boom. He went he went down the hallway and I don't know what he said.
He left with his stuff.
I don't know what he said, but like a minute later, here comes Michael Jackson over to me and he goes, give this man all his stuff back. Give him, you know, whatever money we owe him, you know. This is clearly not our, you know, and I think Max, I don't know what Max said to him, but I think Max pretty much let him know that you're going to give me the stuff back or this whole thing could go to a whole other level, man.
Yeah. He may have just pulled his jacket aside and let him see what was in his waistband, you know?
Yeah. So it was. And that's the last time I ever saw Max. And, wow. But sure enough, that was towards the end, man. And the BBC radio sent in these guys to do a story and they interviewed me on BBC radio about the end of Tower.
Uh-huh.
And I did this interview on the floor. And I think one of the pictures I showed you, I'm holding the jazz sign.
Uh-huh.
And these two guys are from England. They were like the audio visual guys from the BBC, you know, and they were like, you know, there. So tower's going down. What do you have to say? And I, you know, I.
Right.
They wanted like a sound blurb for the radio or whatever. And
right,
I,
right.
I was like, this is horrible, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Literally, exactly.
This is terrible, man. You know.
Yeah.
And then next thing you knew, it was over, man.
Yep.
It was, you know. Yep. And then that was dead. And that was, you know, I kind of pride myself on having, you know, kept my jazz, the jazz part of my life alive. But, you know, along the way of doing that, I, you know, about 10 years at Tower, and then later on, about another 10 years at Sam Ash.
Uh-huh.
You know, I really put in my time.
Yeah.
As close as I could, doing something that got me as close to I could is what I,
yeah,
you know, and not everybody gets to spend now worse than ever. Not too many people get to live as a jazz musician.
Exactly.
And that was then in 2024. It's, you know, I mean, these days, man, I'm just, I spend, my day gig, if you will, is Instacart, man.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Drive. I get people groceries and bring them to their house.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's got it. Yeah.
You know, it's what I do it full time. And, but the cool thing about it is you make your own schedule. So
yeah.
I can still make my gigs and,
that's good.
And, like you were saying, April 11th of this year, I have a record coming out that I've been trying to make for 10 years. It's called,
oh, nice. What's it called?
At a certain point, I started an orchestra called the 12 Houses Orchestra. And, it's on a really good label called, Mahakala, and it's called the Crop Circle Suite. And I have like 16 or 17 people in a big orchestra, and I wrote all the music, I conducted everything, and
nice.
And something I've been trying to have happen for a long, long time.
And this is coming out in April?
April 11th of this year is the release date.
Nice.
And nice. Which I asked for that. That's my 54th birthday. So I asked the label to release it on my birthday in
nice.
In the spring, and they're really cool. And so you know, my music life never stopped, but you know, I certainly miss Francois. You know, that when I think back on the Tower days, Francois was, I mean, he was in that the band with the record coming out.
Right,
he was the
right.
bass player for a long time, and you know. And it's always about the people more than anything else. And like, you know, and lest we forget the great Ken Robertson.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I didn't realize it at the time. You know, Ken and I were adversaries, like generational adversaries.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't hit me until later on just how cool Ken was. Because Ken was one of the doo-wop, he had like sung in doo-wop groups back in the day.
Yep.
And what I didn't realize is that, and he guarded and built the oldie section like a shrine. And and we were adversarial, but what I didn't realize until afterwards is that it was deeper than that. He didn't just represent the oldies themselves. He represented like an entire lifestyle,
A
perspective, a generation. Like a hipness, like he represented a lot of stuff, and was really true ride or die to his own perspective on life, his own creed and everything.
Yeah.
And the old deception was the ultimate example of that. And he had it so tight, man. He ran it like a temple.
Yeah,
I mean, it was perfect. Every card, it was perfectly organized. I mean, and he was the man. And
yeah.
we battled a little bit for silly reasons, but
right.
But we were always cool. And in fact, years later, I got a phone call from him after I had left Sam Ash. He found out there was an in-store that we did with a great jazz singer named Tessa Suter.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken found out where I was. He called me up just to see how I was doing. Asked me about Francois. Thought maybe Francois was dead by that point.
Uh-huh.
Francois wasn't at that point. But and then I talked to Ken one other time after that. But it was really good to hear from him.
Yeah.
And we always, you know, we always had a lot of respect for each other. And then Tessa was the one who I knew from the in-store. Or jazz brunch, I guess really more the jazz brunch series.
Yeah.
That, she was the one that let me know that Ken had become like her mentor and that Ken had passed away. That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, I know. And it wasn't.
So Ken, George, and Francois, man, it was just.
Yeah.
Except for the time this one ex-employee faked his own death on MySpace.
Oh my God.
That's a whole other thing.
That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
All right, Matt Lavelle. Thank you so much for the time and the stories and the reflection. You had a great run at Tower. You continue to have a great run as a musician. We will post something on our social media about the release of your album on April 11th.
Cool.
Looking forward to that. And again, thank you so much for taking the time.
I tell you, it's a lot of fun, man, and very therapeutic in a way to go back and remember all the good times.
Yeah, absolutely. Take care.
thank you, man. Thanks again, Bob. Take care.
Thank you. Oh, my man, Matt can talk. Hey, Matt's jazz project, The 12 Houses, has a release coming out the second week of April. We'll be posting information on our Instagram and Facebook pages so that everybody can check it out. Once again, our thanks to Matt Lavelle for talking with us this week. 2500 Del Monte Street, the oral history of Tower Records, is a production of Busy Buzzy Media. Thank you to Mike Slomo Brenner for providing our theme music and all original music for our production. Please subscribe to and review our podcast wherever you listen. Subscribing to a podcast is free, and every Tuesday morning you'll find the new episode ready for a listen. Also, it would really help if you told a friend or two about us. Check out our Instagram and Facebook pages at Tower Records Podcast. We'd love it if you signed up to follow our Facebook page for regular updates. And don't forget our related Facebook page, Induct Tower Records Russ Solomon into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Join us there in an effort to get Russ Solomon, founder of Tower Records, in the Rock Hall. I'm Bob Zimmerman. Thanks for joining us.